Next week, I won't be here. Okay. We're going to be on vacation.
Oh, good.
And
where
are we going? We're going to a house on the Rappahannock River.
Oh, how fun.
How nice.
It belongs to my son's friend. Uh-huh. And he's letting us use it.
Isn't that nice?
So we're going to be going Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday.
How nice.
Great.
Enjoy.
So we're going to go down there. It's about an hour and a half drive.
That's
from
not too bad,
house, which is not bad, you know.
Yeah.
So we're going to go down there.
How nice.
So we won't be here next week.
Okay.
But we'll be here the following week.
Yeah.
Okay, so where are we? We are charging forth with Sirach. We're starting with chapter 16.
16.
And the subheading for chapter 16 says, "A little well done is better than nothing."
Yeah, that's true.
He's full of these sage advices. You know, we should write some of these down.
Yeah, my mom was great like that. The older generation, right?
Yeah.
They had all these sayings.
Yeah.
The kids don't know them today, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he's got a note here. He says from 16:1 to 16:23, he talks about quality, not quantity, as what matters. Ben Sirach makes the point in a number of ways. The good action of just one person carries more weight than the mediocrity of many. And he said what applies in the family sphere holds good on a grander scale. Whereas the family is like the domestic church, you know, and what you do then, it helps out. Despite what many of the author's contemporaries thought, influenced as they were by the Greek philosophers, God is not a distant being who takes no interest in what individuals do. In fact, he knows and judges everything that happens. Ben Sirach does not have much regard for people with these deist ideas. They are senseless and misguided. And so that's kind of what he's going to be talking about for the next several verses here.
Mm-hmm.
So he begins, he says, "Do not desire a multitude of useless children."
Excuse me.
I thought that was kind of interesting.
There's always a few words,
yeah.
Isn't
that
right?
He says, "Nor rejoice in ungodly sons. If they multiply, do not rejoice in them unless the fear of the Lord is in them. Do not trust in their survival." And in other words, don't count on them to be around to take care of you when you're old. "And do not rely on their multitude. For one is better than 1,000. And to die childless is better than to have ungodly children. For through one man of understanding, a city will be filled with people. But through a tribe of lawless men, it will be made desolate. Many such things my eye has seen, and my ear has heard things more striking than these." But then he's got a little thing that says, "Sinners will be punished." As verse 6 says, "In an assembly of sinners, a fire will be kindled, and in a disobedient nation, wrath was kindled. He was not propitiated for the ancient giants who revolted in their might. He did not spare the neighbors of Lot, whom he loathed on account of their insolence. He showed no pity for a nation devoted to destruction, for those destroyed in their sins. Nor for the 600,000 men on foot who rebelled, who rebelliously assembled in their stubbornness." So he's really recalling a lot of the history of Israel in these things, talking about how God interacted with us.
Mm-hmm. Who was it? Those giants.
Those were the Assyrians.
Oh, they were?
Yeah, I think so. They talk somewhere else about the people of Canaan, the Canaanites.
Hmm. Those were the ancient giants?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I think so. And so he looks at the history of Israel, and he's making the point that God is not this distant thing who doesn't interfere with us. He's always interacting with us, doing stuff. Says he showed no pity for a nation devoted to destruction, for those destroyed in their sins, nor for the 600,000 men on foot who rebelliously assembled in their stubbornness. Even if there is only one stiff-necked person, it will be a wonder if he remains unpunished. For mercy and wrath are with the Lord. He is mighty to forgive, and he pours out wrath. As great as his mercy, so great also is his reproof. He judges a man according to his deeds. The sinner will not escape with his plunder, and the patience of the godly will not be frustrated. He will make room for every act of mercy. Every one who everyone will receive in accordance with his deeds. A lot of this stuff is what Jesus says in the Gospels too, if you remember. It sounds very familiar when you hear it, you know. Do not say, I shall be hidden from the Lord, and who from on high will remember me? Among so many people shall I not be known, for what is my soul in the boundless creation? There's a phrase in one of the Psalms where it says, what is man that God should be mindful of him? Behold, heaven in the highest heaven, the abyss and the earth will tremble at his visitation. The mountains also and the foundations of the earth shake with trembling when he looks upon them. And no mind will reflect on this. Who will ponder his ways? Like a tempest which no man can see, so most of his works are concealed. Who will announce his acts of justice? Or who will await them? For the covenant is far off. This is what one devoid of understanding thinks. A senseless and misguided man thinks foolishly. So at that we end part one of the book. We now get into part two. And the major heading of part two is that God imbues all his works with wisdom. And so his wisdom, you see his wisdom in everything he creates. The order of the universe, you know, the whole nine yards. And then it begins, the introduction says, wisdom in creation. And he's got a note here from 1624 to 2327. These chapters have a kind of a flow to them that we'll see. These chapters are the second of the five parts we can distinguish in the book of Sirach. Like all the other parts, it opens with doctrinal instruction. He begins each one of these five parts with some kind of doctrinal lesson. Dealing with this time with the divine wisdom manifested by the Creator in all of his works. This is followed by a series of practical teachings, like he always does. As in the previous part, it is not easy to see any clear order in the maxims. However, further emphasis is put here on prudence and speech. So the main thing he's going to be talking about in these little maxims is prudence. Okay. You know, just kind of think before you act, you know, kind of thing. And don't open your mouth till you've thought about what you're going to say, because you can't take it back. All those kind of things. He's full of that stuff. And then he says from 1624 to 1814, the first section of that, the doctrinal introduction to the first part of the book summarized the main ideas in the book and put the focus mainly on the Lord, the only God, as being the source of wisdom. Now the author goes on to explain that in creating the universe, the Most High arranged all his works in order and laid down laws to govern them. So he begins to reference teachings from Genesis and all this kind of stuff. So we're going to see a lot of this stuff as we get into this first part of chapter two, part two. So the first line in the part two is verse 24 of 16. It says, listen to me, my son, and acquire knowledge, and pay close attention to my words. I will impart instruction by weight and declare knowledge accurately. He's got a lot of confidence in what he's saying. So the works of the Lord have existed from the beginning by his creation. When he made them, he determined their divisions. What he's saying here is that he doesn't do things haphazardly. He decides what he wants, where he wants it, how he wants it, and all those kind of things. He divides things up according to the way he wants them to be. He arranged his works in an eternal order and their dominion for all generations. They neither hunger nor grow weary, and they do not cease from their labors. They do not crowd one another aside, and they will never disobey his word. He's talking about creation, not people.
The order of creation.
The order of creation and not people. Because if you say they don't get hungry and they never get weary, people, what kind of people do that, you know? No, he's not talking about people here. He's talking about his creation. After this, the Lord looked upon the earth and filled it with his good things. With all kinds of living beings, he covered its surface, and to it they return. That's the first hint he does it again later. It's the first hint he has that the thing where, you know, from dust thou art to dust thou shalt return, right, kind of thing. Well, that's what he's talking about here. It says, the Lord created man out of earth and turned him back to it again. That's the beginning of chapter 17. He gave to men a few days, a limited time, but granted them authority over the things upon the earth. These are all gifts that God has given to man. He endowed them with strength like his own and made them in his own image. And let's see. Yeah. I want to point out something here, too. In the footnotes, there's a thing from John Paul II in Fides et Ratio, Faith and Reason. It says, the doctrinal introduction to this second part of the book concludes with reflections on the majesty and compassion of God, so vast compared to man. And we'll get to that in chapter 8, the first part of chapter 18. Having established just how limited man is, Ben Sirach asks himself, what is man, and what good can he do? God is under no obligation to care for man, to encourage him to do good, or to guard him against evil. This sapiential style of writing is rhetorical. It is meant to draw attention to God's kindness and mercy towards man. Whereas he's asking a question here. Mm-hmm. Does God really care about man? You know, and then the answer, of course, that he does. The sacred writer does not have access to God's last revelation in the form of Jesus Christ, but by contemplating God's favors to Israel, he is able to get more insights into man and the nature of man. So John Paul points out, these are questions in every human heart. As the poetic genius of every time and every people has shown, posing again and again, almost as the prophetic voice of humanity, the serious question which makes human beings truly what they are. In other words, they are rational beings with an immortal soul. Mm. They are questions which express the urgency of finding a reason for existence in every moment, at life's most important and decisive times as well as more ordinary times. These questions show the deep reasonableness of human existence, since they summon human intelligence and will to search freely for a solution which can reveal the full meaning of life. And the solution is, of course, God, Jesus. These inquiries, therefore, are the highest expression of human nature, which is why the answer to them is the gauge of the depth of his engagement with his own existence. In particular, when the why of things is explored in full harmony with the search for the ultimate answer, then human reason reaches its zenith and opens to the religious impulse. The religious impulse is the highest expression of the human person. This impulse he's talking about is our desire to be in union with God. Mm-hmm. That's the highest impulse.
And that
we
impulse
have.
Comes from the Holy Spirit.
With the Holy Spirit,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It springs from the profound human aspiration for the truth, and it is the basis of the human being's free and personal search for the divine. And we've had a hint of that in the daily readings at Mass. I think it was last week or the week before. It was in the book of Hosea, where it talks about, you know, God is going to be your husband. And it's got a few lines that relate to that. It was in one of the daily readings. That's chapter 2 of Hosea, I think it was. But then in Isaiah, in chapter, see, the 55:4 or 54:5, I can't ever remember which is which, but it says, your maker shall be your husband. Your maker shall be your spouse. And so this whole idea shows up in both of the prophets, both Hosea and Isaiah, the same concept. And it's the idea that the ultimate thing we can have is to be in that kind of a union with God, where God is the spiritual spouse of our soul. And Jesus fulfills that when he gives us the Eucharist, because he's bringing us to spiritual marriage with himself. And we don't sense it, because if we did, we'd probably get too conceited and lose all the benefit of it. But that's what we have in heaven. And that's why the saints say, right now we can't ever know what it'll be like in heaven, because we can't experience that right now, even though it's beginning to happen already in our souls. Because when Jesus comes to us totally, he's giving himself, body, blood, soul, and divinity to us in its entirety. And that's what you do in a marriage. The husband and wife give themselves to each other completely. So he wants us to do the same thing when we receive communion. We don't just receive and say, gee, thanks, you know. We say, I give myself to you in return, all without reservation, you know, in my entirety. And that's the kind of thing he wants us to do each time we receive.
One of the saints, Saint Teresa of Avila, she had that whole notion,
right,
of spiritual espousal.
Right.
And then there was another saint, I can't remember her name, but Jesus appeared to her and put a wedding ring on her finger. Mm-hmm. And she knew
quite a few of them.
Yeah, right. The spiritual espousals. That's
right.
But they knew about that. Like,
right.
They knew they were in a different category.
And so a lot of the saints, and you know, and of course, like in the prophets that we just said, they're aware of that, and they're aware. And Blessed Mother has told some of the visionaries that you begin to live your heaven here on earth, and that's how you do that, by getting into that spiritual union with God. She told one of the kids in Medjugorje that when you pass into eternity, you hardly notice it. It's like just moving into the next day or next hour, you know, and it's not this traumatic thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're not in a good state of grace,
then you need Saint Joseph.
Yeah, but you need a lot if you're not in a state of grace, because it's a very traumatic thing. Because all of a sudden, I mean, you see yourself as God sees you, and say, "Oh my God, is that really me?" You know, it could be very traumatic for some people.
So, I mean, confession really helps a person.
Mm-hmm.
You do see yourself, and you have to see your sins. You're not going to be, we're all going to be shocked because we don't see ourselves as God sees us.
And that's part of why Teresa talks to us here at Castle about here's George trying to come on. Hi, George.
Hi, Jim.
And that's why Teresa talks to her. We're starting chapter 17. We're about to begin chapter 17 of Sirach. That's why Teresa talks about, you know, always having to come back to the rooms of self-knowledge and humility. And self-knowledge is, you know, what do I look like before Jesus? And how do I compare to Jesus? How close do I resemble him? Because he said, imitate me, for I'm meek and humble of heart. You know, so how well do we imitate him? And then humility is not comparing yourself to somebody else, but you're comparing yourself to Jesus. You know, and it doesn't mean you sit down there and say, oh, I'm such a miserable little worm and everything. It's admitting that humility is admitting the truth about yourself. Am I getting closer to God or am I not? If I am, what am I doing that's helping that, and can I continue that? Can I do better? If I'm not getting close enough, what can I do better to get closer? Mm. You know, it's just admitting that truth about yourself, you know, and don't deceive yourself. Don't think you're a lot closer than you really are. You know, just look at yourself and, you know, what is your prayer life like? You know, and you do those kind of things.
That must be why so many of the saints you read sound like they feel like they're a little worm. But they're just in comparing themselves.
Comparing themselves to Christ, right.
It seems so extreme and unrealistic for them to talk that way. And you think, do I have to feel that way? But in relationship with
Exactly.
God.
Exactly, yeah. And so Jesus talks to some of the saints. You know, he says, in your misery, you know, do this and whatever. And he's saying that compared to me, you're kind of miserable, but I'm here to help you.
Right.
That's his job. That's his goal, to help every one of us get to heaven. Because people think of the kingdom of heaven as being a place. It's how big is the kingdom of heaven? Well, it's got 1,000 acres, you know. Well, no, it's not a territory. It's a people. That's why he says heaven is like a mustard seed. You know, you plant the seed. He plants the seed, and then every one of the leaves on that bush is somebody who gets to heaven. And the bigger the bush, the bigger the kingdom of heaven. He wants the biggest kingdom he can get. That's why he wants conversion. He says this, you know, all the saints in heaven, angels, is more rejoicing over one sinner who repents than those who don't have to, you know, because he wants that conversion of heart. And the more people that convert, the bigger the kingdom of heaven is. And that's what he's trying to get to.
Well, and Jesus said, I'm not good on remembering these verses, but like the kingdom of heaven is now. Jesus came. It's now.
Yeah. The kingdom of heaven is where he is. You know? And so he wants him to be in our soul. Mm-hmm. Remember what he said, John 14:23, you know? If any man loves me, he will keep my word, and we will dwell in him. You know, he wants the kingdom of God to be inside of you. And that's really it's a super important concept.
But sometimes you get mixed up with the New Jerusalem, and which is really the same thing, but it sounds like it's 1,000 acres.
Yeah. But the New Jerusalem, well, it's also going to be a place, because at the resurrection, we're going to get our bodies back, right? So we can't have bodies floating around in space somewhere. That wouldn't be much fun, I don't think. Yeah. So we're going to have to reside someplace.
Yeah.
And Jesus says, in my Father's house, there are many mansions. And I'm going to go to prayer, prepare a place for you. Well, he's probably talking about after the resurrection as well as before. You know, there's a place for us immediately, but there's also going to be a place after the resurrection. And so that's going to be a nice thing for us, you know?
Yeah.
We're each going to have our own little mansion.
Yeah.
You know? It's
with no lawn service, right? It'll be fine.
Yeah, there's no need lawn service. We'll have goats to eat the grass for us, you know? We won't need a lawn service. I'd rather have goats than sheep, because goats are much more fun to play with.
But they get that grass, pull it out by the root.
Sheep do, yeah.
Oh, I thought goats did.
Goats don't like to eat grass. They eat bushes.
Oh, gosh, we learned something new every week.
Yeah. Yeah, we used to have goats, so they'd much prefer. But what we used to take them for walks through the woods.
Oh, yeah.
And every time they got to a tulip poplar tree, they'd go crazy.
Really?
We'd have to pull the branches down. They'd just...
There was something on TV. They wanted to clean out this particular area in Northern Virginia. They got the goats in.
Yeah.
And they ate all the brush. It was priceless. They were nibbling it like...
Oh, they do it. That along the Ohio River.
Really?
They do it fast, too. They do it fast. There are people that have herds of goats that rent them out like that for people.
Huh. Yeah.
To get rid of brush and stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. We tried that. A lot is 58 acres, and it's almost all forest.
Yeah.
And so we got these goats, and we tried to do that. Well, we got these portable fences and put them around different places for them to clean up.
Yeah.
In one day, they were going. We were moving fences every day. It was driving us crazy.
And they take out the rose bushes and
hostas and everything else.
Stay,
yeah.
Because
they love hostas.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough goats. Let's get back to our Sirach here. So we start in chapter 17, and the subtitle of that is God and Man. So now he's talking about the relationship between God and man. And that's really what our whole life is about, you know. The Lord created man out of earth and turned him back to it again. He gave to men a few days, a limited time, but granted them authority over the things upon the earth. He endowed them with strength like his own and made them in his own image. What do you think he's talking about? Strength like his own.
Grace.
We're not as strong as God, right?
No.
There's a little note at the bottom down here, because I was kind of confused when I saw that. But it says, proper to them. Strength is like his own. God's strength is proper to God. Mm-hmm. Man's strength is proper to man.
Okay.
So it says, the note says, it really means... like his own proper to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps you understand what he's the point he's making here. And made them in his own image. It says so in Genesis. He placed the fear of them in all living beings. I don't think a grizzly bear would be afraid of me. But anyway. But there's a note here. It says, instead of the word them, there's a note there, it says in the Greek, it says him.
Hmm.
So maybe it means him, you know, not them. So he's, and then if you notice, if you're numbering, it goes from 4 to 6.
Hmm.
Did you notice the phrases? Okay. So they have, it says, other authorities add a verse 5. And the verse 5 they add is, which is not in our Bible, says, they obtained the use of the five operations of the Lord, As sixth, he distributed to them the gift of mind. And as a seventh reason, the interpreter of his operations.
So does he mean the five senses?
So it must
plus
be, yeah. Must
reason.
Be, yeah. Okay. Right. So they added that fifth verse there. And then we go on to verse 6. And he prefaces that with says, other our authorities add. So apparently other people that have been looked at this have added that phrase in. Okay. And granted them dominion over the beasts and birds. He made for them tongue and eyes. He gave them ears and a mind for thinking. He filled them with knowledge and understanding and showed them good and evil. He set his eye upon their hearts. And again, we see here, it goes from 8 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a verse 9 from other authorities. And it says, other authorities add, and he gave them to boast of his marvels forever. He says, he set his eye upon their hearts to show them the majesty of his works, and he gave them to boast of his marvels forever. He wants to, nobody wants to praise him for his works.
Mine has it in.
And they will praise his holy name to proclaim the grandeur of his works. He bestowed knowledge upon them and allotted to them the law of life. He established with them an eternal covenant and showed them his judgments. He makes the point that God's covenants are always eternal. In other words, he doesn't change. He doesn't take back his covenants. It's man who breaks the covenant, not God. God never breaks his covenants. Their eyes saw his glorious majesty, and their ears heard the glory of his voice. And he said to them, beware of all unrighteousness. There's a note here. It says, an alternative translation there is, or beware of every unrighteous man. And he gave commandment to each of them concerning his neighbor. Those would be the four through the Ten Commandments. Because all those deal with how we deal with other people. Our parents and our neighbors and our spouses and everything else. Then the next session begins in verse 15. And the subtitle of that is The Divine Judge, A Call to Repentance. So here's where he's going to talk about that God is going to really judge all of our acts. He's not far from us. He always knows what we're doing. He sees us and he'll judge us by what we do. And again, if you notice, it goes 15 to 17 to 19. There's no 16 and there's no 18. So we have some more 16s and 18s here. I've got them, you don't, so I'll read them to you. That's one thing I like about this Navarro Bible. It adds all kind of good stuff in here, you know. So 15 says, their ways are always before him. They will not be hid from his eyes. And other authorities add a verse 6. Pardon?
It's okay.
Somebody says something?
No.
Okay. Says other authorities add a verse 16. Their ways from youth tend toward evil, and they are unable to make for themselves hearts of flesh in place of their stony hearts. So God has to do that for us. He appointed a ruler for every nation, but Israel is the Lord's own portion. And then he's got a thing between 17 and 19. For in the division of nations, for in the division of the nations of the whole earth, what's going on? I'm trying to figure out what they're trying to say here. Okay. Oh, it's a substitute for 17. He appointed a ruler for every nation, and there's a saying, for in the division of the nations of the whole earth, he appointed a ruler for every nation, but Israel is the Lord's own portion. And then there's an 18 after the Lord's own portion. Other authorities add, whom being his firstborn, he brings up with discipline, and allotting to him the light of his love, he does not neglect him. But Israel is the Lord's own portion. And then following that, it says, whom being his first, he's looking at Israel as his firstborn, the chosen people. First chosen people that he's ever chosen.
Until they asked for a king, right?
Until they asked for a king, right. Right. It said that all their works are as the sun before him, and his eyes are continually upon their ways. So he's not distant from them. He sees everything they do and watches everything they do. Their iniquities are not hidden from him, and all their sins are before the Lord. There's also a 21. It said other authorities add, but the Lord, who is gracious and knows his creatures, has neither left nor abandoned them, but spared them. A man's almsgiving is like a signet with the Lord, and he will keep a person's kindness like the apple of his eye. Afterward, he will arise and requite them, and he will bring their recompense on their heads. Yet to those who repent, he grants a return, and he encourages those whose endurance is failing. So persevere. Don't give up, you know. And then there's a section that kind of addresses the issue of conversion. He wants us to convert our hearts and turn back to him. It starts with 25. He says, turn to the Lord and forsake your sins. Pray in his presence and lessen your offenses. So he wants us to go before him to pray, to recognize that he's there, and then pray with that recognition. Don't just kind of pray to the stars or something, you know. Go before the Lord. Call upon him and go before him and then pray in his presence. Return to the Most High and turn away from iniquity and hate abominations intensely. And there's a why here. It said other authorities add, for he will lead you out of darkness to the light of health. So when you call upon him, he's going to help. He's not going to abandon you. Then 27 says, who will sing the praises to the Most High in Hades, as do those who are alive and give thanks? So when you're in Hades, you can't pray. From the dead as from one who does not exist, thanksgiving has ceased. He who is alive and well sings the Lord's praises. How great is the mercy of the Lord, his forgiveness for those who turn to him. For all things cannot be in men, since the Son of Man is not immortal. I had a question when I came to that. Since the Son of Man is not immortal, mm-hmm. Two things come to mind. Mm-hmm. One is we have to become sons of God in order to receive our immortality. Mm-hmm. Our soul's immortal, but to be a son of God and go to heaven, we need to be in a state of grace. Mm-hmm. And so we have to become a son of God, not just a son of man, to achieve that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 31, what is brighter than the sun? Yet its light fails. And it's got a note here, it says, or suffers an eclipse. Mm-hmm. So you could read that, what is brighter than the sun? Yet its light suffers an eclipse. So flesh and blood devise evil. He marshals the host of the height of heaven, but all men are dust and ashes. There's something that, and then we'll get into chapter 18 here. It's something he does throughout here that's kind of interesting. He doesn't really talk any about the afterlife. He doesn't know anything about the afterlife yet. He hasn't had the revelation fully from God, and of course not from Jesus, because he was long before. And so you don't see a lot of references to what the afterlife is like, or even talking about it. He just knows it. Something's there, but it doesn't know what it is or anything else. And so he doesn't really talk about that much.
So there weren't, in his age, Sadducees and Pharisees. Because the Sadducees never believed in an afterlife, did they?
That's right, that's right. They didn't. They didn't believe in a resurrection, right? I never could figure out why they even believed.
Then,
if you don't believe in a resurrection, why?
Your faith is in vain.
That's right. I mean, all your faith is in vain if you don't believe in a resurrection. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And yet that's what they did. So,
it's a conundrum.
So the next thing begins chapter 18, and the subheading for chapter 18 is the greatness of God and the littleness of man. And we'll see a lot of stuff in here that talk about dependency on God, the generosity of God, and God's mercy as we go through here. So begins, he who lives forever created the whole universe. The Lord alone will be declared righteous. And he says other authorities add, and there is no other beside him. Which kind of is reflective of the first commandment. I am the Lord, there's no other gods beside me. To none has he given power to proclaim his works. And who can search out his mighty deeds? Who can measure his majestic power, and who can fully recount his mercies? It is not possible to diminish or increase them, nor is it possible to trace the wonders of the Lord. When a man has finished, he is just beginning. And when he stops, he will be at a loss. What is man, and of what use is he? What is his good, and what is his evil? The number of a man's days is great if he reaches 100 years. Like a drop of water from the sea and a grain of sand, so are a few years in the day of eternity. So, you know, compared to eternity, our life is very short. That's the point he's making here. Therefore, the Lord is patient with them and pours out his mercy upon them. He sees and recognizes that their end will be evil. Therefore, he grants them forgiveness in abundance. To me, that meant he sees and recognizes that their end will be evil if left to themselves without my intervention. Therefore, he grants them forgiveness in abundance. The compassion of man is for his neighbor, but the compassion of the Lord is for all living beings, which he loves his creation. He rebukes and trains and teaches them and turns them back as a shepherd his flock. He has compassion on those who accept his discipline and who are eager for his judgments. See, he wants people to go to him and say, you know, show me what I'm doing wrong. Help me live a good life. Help me live a righteous life. Help me do that. And then we get to verse 15. It's got a subheading called Reflection and Foresight. And it's got a central idea here. Listen and think before you speak. Use prudence. And when I read that, I couldn't help but think about that account of the guy who made a vow to God. He said, if I win this battle, when I come back, I will slay the first person who walks out this door. And he goes and wins the battle, comes back, first person to walk out the door is his daughter. And his daughter says, you have to keep the vow. You can't make a vow to God, you can't break a vow to God.
Yeah, I heard that.
What,
is that in the Bible?
Yeah. Ooh. And I forget which book it's in. But then she says, give me a month to go and mourn my virginity. and then I'll come back and you can kill me.
I remember that reading way back, right?
Yes. It sticks in your head.
Right.
So she goes back.
Yeah.
She goes out with her friends, mourns her virginity for a month, comes back, and her father kills her. He feels obligated because he made a vow to God he can't break. And so the lesson for that whole thing is be careful about what you say. You know, don't make foolish things like that.
I forget it's like today's reading, who loves his son or daughter better than me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's, I wish I could remember the book it's in, but it really struck me when when I first read that. I said, I mean, how stupid can you be to do something like that, you know? But I mean, but again, it's that's the advice he's given here.
Yeah.
You know, think before you speak, you know? Think about the consequences of what you're saying here.
Yeah.
So it begins in verse 15. And they got a note here for verses 15 through 29. It says, at the center of these counsels on the subject of prudence comes one that says, before you speak, learn. Although it might appear rather banal, it is in fact a very wise saying because it reminds us that we need to know the facts before deciding what we should say or do. Don't start talking until you know what you're talking about. So my son, do not mix reproach with your good deeds, nor cause grief by your words when you present a gift. Does not the dew assuage the scorching heat? So a word is better than a gift. Indeed, does not a word surpass a good gift? Both are to be found in a gracious man. A fool is ungracious and abusive. So it says, before you speak, a fool is ungracious and abusive, and the gift of a grudging man makes the eye dim. Hmm. I thought that was an odd statement.
Jim, sorry.
Yeah.
I found it. Judges chapter 11. And she said to her father, grant only me this which I desire. Let me go that I may mourn. Let me go about the mountains for months to bewail my virginity with my companion.
Which book is that?
Judges, chapter 11, verse 35.
Judges 11, 35. I knew I read it somewhere. I couldn't remember where.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah,
thank you, Alan. Appreciate it.
What book was it?
You always come through for us.
Okay. 35.
Before you speak, learn. And before you fall ill, take care of your health. Before judgment, examine yourself. And in the hour of visitation, you will find forgiveness. Before falling ill, humble yourself, and when you are on the point of sinning, turn back. Think about what you're about to do, and don't do it. Before judgment, examine yourself. That's kind of what Jesus said about the plank in your brother's eye. You know, before judging others, think of yourself. Examine yourself. A lot of the things he talks about here, we see reflected in a lot of the teachings that Jesus gave in the Gospels.
Yep. Yeah.
I think maybe Jesus knew this. Let nothing hinder you from paying a vow promptly, and do not wait until death to be released from it. Before making a vow, prepare yourself, and do not be like a man who tempts the Lord. Think of his wrath on the day of death, and of the moment of vengeance when he turns away his face. You should think of that every day, not just on the day of death.
Yeah.
Think of where you stand before God.
And I was reading yesterday in one of the books. It was a book on prayer by Bishop Sheen. Amazing. And he said, just live each day as if it's your last.
This is the last day. That's right.
You know, he said, even live the morning as if the noon you might not be here. How we would, you know.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's hard to say.
Yeah.
In the time of plenty, think of the time of hunger. In the time of wealth, think of poverty and need. From morning to evening, conditions change, and all things move swiftly before the Lord. A wise man is cautious in everything, and in days of sin he guards against wrongdoing. Every intelligent man knows wisdom, and he praises the one who finds her. Those who understand sayings become skilled themselves and pour forth apt proverbs. And then he's got a section beginning on verse 30 called self-control. And when I read that, I was thinking of what Jesus said about, you know, seek only what is good and build up treasure in heaven, mm-hmm. not on earth.
Mm-hmm.
It says,
might be good for a silver something.
Okay.
Angel.
So then we have this thing on self-control. He says, do not follow your base desires, but restrain your appetites. If you allow your soul to take pleasure in base desire, it will make you the laughingstock of your enemies. Do not revel in great luxury, lest you become impoverished by its expense. Do not become a beggar by feasting with borrowed money when you have nothing in your purse. And then we get to chapter 19, and he continues these same kinds of lessons. So a workman who is a drunkard will not become rich. He who despises small things will fail little by little. Wine and women lead intelligent men astray, and the man who consorts with harlots is very reckless. In fact, Paul says that the fornicators cannot enter the kingdom of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Decay and worms will inherit him, and the reckless soul will be snatched away. And then in verse 4, it begins another section with this heading, putting an end to loose talk. So he's still talking about this whole idea. Watch your tongue. I used to know a judge that when people would say things that they shouldn't say and to go to court over and all, he says, you can't unring a bell. You know, once you've said something, it's said, you know, you can't take it back.
And you know that saying, like every word that we say, we have to account for. I mean, that's mine.
Oh. Yeah.
That must and go right along with this.
Yeah, and that's exactly what he's talking about here.
Ooh.
You know. So he's getting into listen and think. Mm-hmm. One who trusts others too quickly is light-minded, and one who sins does wrong to himself. One who rejoices in wickedness will be condemned. And then it's got a note here that other authorities add, but he who withstands pleasures crowns his life. He who controls his tongue will live without strife. And for one who hates gossip, evil is lessened. Never repeat a conversation. In other words, don't gossip.
Mm-hmm.
And you will lose nothing at all. With friend or foe, do not report it. And unless it would be a sin for you, do not disclose it. That was an interesting, interesting thing there. You know, unless it would be a sin, do not disclose it.
Mm.
Sometimes you've got to mention something.
Yeah.
Otherwise, evil will happen.
Yeah.
But otherwise, keep your mouth shut. You know? For someone who has heard you and watched you, and when the time comes, he will hate you. When I read that, I started thinking about this January 6th committee, and this lady that gave this testimony that was all hearsay and everything, and it turned out to be a lot of baloney.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It was just, it just kind of fit right in with this reading here.
So the whole thing fit in with all of this.
Right.
Have you heard a word? Let it die with you. Be brave. it will not make you burst. I thought that was really funny.
Maybe go into a room and say it out loud to yourself.
Yeah, yeah. But I gotta tell him. Yeah. With such a word, a fool will suffer pangs, like a woman in labor with a child, like an arrow stuck in the flesh of the thigh. So is a word inside a fool. Question a friend. Perhaps he did not do it. But if he did anything, so that he may do it no more. Whereas if you hear something, as somebody said, go question.
Yeah.
Ask them if they really said it. If they did, if they didn't, yeah. If they did, then counsel them not to do that again. It would give them good advice.
Yeah.
Question a neighbor. Perhaps he did not say it. But if he said it, so that he may not say it again. So you're helping your neighbors live a righteous life.
And that's how grudges probably keep going.
Sure.
You know, for
sure.
years and years.
Sure.
I mean, there was one thing in John's family, so we used to laugh about it. His mother used to have the parents over for certain holidays, and so did the brother, and they shared it. Well, one year she had two holidays. No, the brother did. And she took such offense. She never talked to the brother.
Oh, I know. Little things like
that. Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, I don't know if they ever worked it out, but I mean, like, just,
yeah.
You know, common, yeah.
Yeah.
It's such small things that...
So he says, question a friend. Question a friend, for often it is slander. So do not believe everything you hear. So if you hear something about somebody, ask them if it's really true. Because it might just be slander.
So if they tell you themselves... Are you able to repeat it then?
Only if they give you permission.
Yeah, okay.
Mm.
You know? You want to treat a lot of what people say the way a lawyer treats what his clients tell him. You know, the attorney-client privilege thing.
Yeah.
When I do spiritual direction with people, I never, first of all, say who I do it for. That's up to them, not me. And whatever they say, I never repeat. If they want to repeat it, that's fine.
Yeah.
But I treat it the way you do a lawyer-client privilege
thing. But if
they
want to repeat it because they don't see it as wrong, then can you repeat it? I'm thinking of somebody.
I would say no.
Well, some people might repeat what you say if they think it'd be helpful for somebody else. Hmm. So if I'm doing direction with somebody and I give them advice on something, they might find that advice helpful for somebody else, mm-hmm. so they could tell that person the same thing. You know, but it's not up to me to do that, because that's, to me, a privileged communication.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a person may make a slip without intending it. Who has never sinned with his tongue? Question your neighbor before you threaten him, and let the law of the Most High take its course. Now, if you notice, there's 16, 17, and there's no 18 and 19.
Mm-hmm.
So we got another one of those things.
Strange. Yeah.
So the last line here says that the law of the Most High take its course, and other authorities add, and do not be angry. Mm-hmm. And then there's 18, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of acceptance, and wisdom obtains his love. And then 19, the knowledge of the Lord's commandments is life-giving discipline. And those who do what is pleasing to him enjoy the fruit of the tree of immortality. So that was there. And then at the end of the fulfillment of law, he says, other authorities add, where it says, and in all wisdom there is the fulfillment of the law. And it says, other authorities add, and the knowledge of his omnipotence. And in all wisdom there is fulfillment of law and the knowledge of his omnipotence. And then there's, if you notice, note 21 there. So there's the other authorities added a 21. Right after that it says, when a servant says to his master, I will not act as you wish, even if later he does it, he angers the one who supports him. So if you're a servant, you can do what your master says. We're servants of God. Hmm. We should do what God says. Follow the commandments. It says, but the knowledge of wickedness is not wisdom, nor is there prudence where sinners take counsel. There is a cleverness which is abominable, because the devil is very clever, but he's abominable. Hmm. But there is a fool who merely lacks wisdom. Better is the God-fearing man who lacks intelligence than the highly prudent man who transgresses the law. There is a cleverness which is scrupulous but unjust, and there are people who distort kindness to gain a verdict. There is a rascal bowed down in mourning, but inwardly he is full of deceit. And he's got a note here for 1920 to 2021. He says sometimes it is difficult to work out where prudence begins and cleverness ends, which is why these maxims are preceded by the refrain that runs through the book: all wisdom is the fear of the Lord, and in all wisdom is the fulfillment of the law. True wisdom is fear of God, which includes reverence and love. Without fear of the Lord, wisdom does not even begin to exist. Much less can it reach perfection. A desire to follow the path of wisdom disposes a person to practice the law, because the divine law covers the road to wisdom and the rules of that road. In a sense, then, wisdom, fear of the Lord, and the practice of the law are one and the same thing. So it's 10:30. We'll stop here and pick up with verse 27 next time. And don't forget, I will not be here next week. I'll be on vacation, so
enjoy.
Come again in 2 weeks. Thank you very much. Anybody have any thoughts about anything we covered today?
Good. It's good.
Okay. No,
it's all common sense.
Yeah.
A lot of it is. Yeah.
A lot of it we've heard.
And it's interesting how a lot of it, though, a lot of it does not draw on the fullness of revelation from Christ. You see a lot of things in here that you also see in the teachings of Christ.
Yeah.
But the fullness is not there.
Right.
You know, and Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven and what it's like and all. Well, he doesn't know that, you know.
Yeah.
And so Jesus had to reveal that to us.
Yeah.
And so a lot of those kind of things, he doesn't know what to say. He says, be good, because he's going to take care of you, but I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's like, you know.
Yeah.
But he knows it's good because it comes from God.
Right.
Yeah, you can see the difference between this and what Jesus said.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It just kind of adds that fullness to it, you know.
Yeah.
But he's full of good advice, you know.
Now to live it all, right?
Yeah. Okay.
That's good. I think it's perhaps the love. Love.
Yeah, that's probably true.
God's love.
God's love is everything.
And mercy.
God's love is the most powerful force in the universe.
Yeah.
So that's something to think about, too. There's nothing more powerful than God's love.
And you can't go wrong doing your best to follow the commandments, God.
Right. Right. Well, others may think you're nuts.
Yep.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts?
Nope. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Have a great 2 weeks. See you in 2 weeks.
Thank you. Enjoy your vacation.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's up. Yeah. I'm thinking of our mutual friend.